Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming your way from San Francisco. Your humble host is grateful to people who voluntarily support this program with subscriptions starting at $5 a month, including Created by Gail, or just Gail, my own Hearst Foundation, Gillian G. Hearst, and Don Cisney. If you're able and you'd like to help, I could use it. Go to my website at peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage. Coming up shortly, Gary Chu will return to our program, the official film reviewer, and his friend Mike Miller. They started out in radio and television in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back, we were still using cathode ray tubes. And Mike Miller has a new book, and he's going to share some of his recollections from a career as a newsman and a political advisor. Hope you'll find it interesting, particularly if you follow the media and want to hear some inside stories. I had hoped to lead off today's podcast with a live update from the protests at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., but five different contacts are not answering their phones right now, and today is a kind of day of reckoning there in Washington. As the people have the permit that they had for Freedom Plaza expired at 2 o'clock Eastern time, and the protesters' future is a little bit uncertain. They've been working with the police, and from what we can tell, the conversations have been relatively friendly, not nearly as contentious as the protesters on Wall Street in New York have discovered. But it appears they're either in a meeting or huddling, having one of their general assemblies. I'm unable to reach them as we hit our deadline here, and I do want to get this podcast out today. So I encourage you to follow the activities in Washington at the website October2011.org. That's October2011.org, and they have a live video stream and also video archives. The latest notice posted here is that last night, as their permit was expiring, the protesters held a dance party. And it reads here, "When we could dance no more, we went to sleep in Freedom Plaza." And so it's unclear exactly what will happen next in Washington, but we are watching this carefully. Now, over the weekend, I want to draw your attention to a demonstration that was held by these protesters. They marched to the Smithsonian's Air and Smith Museum, the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum, which is on the National Mall there in Washington. And as the protesters arrived, their intention was to unfurl some banners and carry some signs critical of an exhibit at the Air and Space Museum about the new generation of unmanned aerial drones, the Raptor and its companions, that have become a focal point of American military advances and aggressive use. And it started in Pakistan, as many people know, and in the theater in Afghanistan. And President Obama has widely expanded the use of drones, and most recently killed an American citizen, much to my chagrin, over the process in particular, using a drone strike in the broken nation of Yemen. So one of the things that occurred is that one individual was pepper sprayed, one of the members of this protest group. and the New York Times and other media outlets reported it without appropriate commentary, just saying that the museum was closed after anti-war demonstrators tried to enter the building to protest a drone exhibit. It reads, this is an AP story that was published on the Times website, at least one person was pepper sprayed. Well, it doesn't report who that person was, and I'd like to disclose that to you. That person is an editor for the American Spectator, who published a column the next day describing his role as a provocateur who had infiltrated the ranks at Freedom Plaza the day before, went with them to the Air and Space Museum, and he was the one who provoked a scuffle and a confrontation with security guards because he busted away from the group, went running through the museum, being chased by security guards, and one of them ultimately pepper sprayed him. And you've got to go online and either find the article or hold your nose and go to the American Spectator's website, because this man's name is Patrick Howley, and he is an assistant editor of the American Spectator, and he wrote a tell-all story where he talks about what a wonderful guy he is and is critical of the protesters because he thinks they're not ballsy enough. Halsey says he joined the group in its march toward the Air and Space Museum, but the protesters were unwilling to be confrontational. He states they lacked the nerve to confront authority. From estimates within the protest, only 10 people were pepper sprayed, and as far as I could tell, I was the only one who got inside. He claims that on arriving at the museum, the group of approximately 100 protesters split into two groups, and the smaller of the two was rushing the doors, the majority staying behind. Howley admits in his piece that he snuck past the guard at the first entrance in order to infiltrate the building and then confronted another guard. He then sprinted toward the door, at which time he was first hit with pepper spray. Next, he says, I forced myself into the doors and sprinted blindly across the floor of the Air and Space Museum, drawing the attention of hundreds of stunned khaki-clad tourists. Fully inside, despite the orders of the security guards that the museum was closed to the public, Howley made his way upstairs to a location where a banner was unfurled protesting the drone weapons. Quote, I strained to glance behind me at the dozens of protesters I was sure were backing me up, and then I got hit again, this time with a cold realization. I was the only one who had made it through the doors. So, the scene as reported by the New York Times is that the protesters got into the museum. And here's a provocateur from the Andrew Breitbart School of Journalism who is saying he's the only one who got inside. Then he found himself stumbling around, and he said the guards came through and swept everyone out as alarms sounded. Make your way to the exits immediately, the guards said. And then this guy, Howley, writes that, I ducked through the confused tourists and raced out the exit. Hey, you, shouted a female guard, reaching for my arm. Get back here. But I was already down the steps and out of sight. So I take this on a number of levels. First of all, it's somewhat encouraging that the American Spectator and presumably other conservatives are so concerned about the potential impact of these protests that they feel the need to infiltrate, become provocative, and try to create scenes that embarrass these peaceful protesters who have a very powerful message. And the second piece of it is that the corporate media is just like they treat Andrew Breitbart and the Acorn takedown and the phony videotape that was concocted to embarrass NPR executives. This is fake news. This is a concoction clearly intended to undermine and embarrass the protesters who were there, I think, in great sincerity and speaking for the rest of us, the 99%. So I wanted to get that to you today, encourage you to go online, read that for yourself. and visit the website October2011.org and keep tabs on the activities in Washington, D.C. A little nostalgia for local television news next on the Peter B. Collins Show.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised.
The late Gil Scott-Heron, with some rich references to the Nixon era. And we're going to go back to those days and some in between now and then. Mike Miller has published a new book, his personal memoir, called How High Can a Guy Stoop? He worked in television news in Tulsa, in Little Rock, in Washington, D.C., and probably a few other stops that we'll mention. And he also worked in politics for a number of Republican elected officials, notably James Inhofe, who is now a senator from Oklahoma, and also former Nevada Senator Chick Hecht. Among others. And I want to thank you for joining us today, Mike Miller, and I truly enjoyed reading your book and catching up with your history.
Well, thank you, Peter. It was a lot of fun to write. Brought back so many memories. Started on it about 40 years ago, just keeping notes. Used to have drinks with some of the other reporters and photographers up in D.C. in my first job up there. And, you know, you'd tell war stories, and they'd say, you know, you got to write a book. So That's when I started taking notes.
Well, and I also want to thank the other gentleman who was with us today, Gary Chu. Gary is the official movie reviewer here on the Peter B. Collins Show, and we have his latest review of George Clooney's Ides of March coming up at the end of this podcast. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Peter B. Good to be on the line, and great to hear Mike's voice again.
Well, and Gary, it's your fault. You introduced Mike Miller to me, and he sent me his book a couple of months ago, and it's been on my reading stack. And when I got to it, I just really enjoyed it, Mike, because your voice is authentic. I feel the ups and downs of your career. I've had one like that.
I think we all have.
Yeah. And let me just start with one of the things I identified with is you got an exclusive interview with Bob Hope. And after you completed it, you realized that your tape recorder was, for some reason, not capturing it. And I've done that at least four times. One time I had to borrow batteries from an interview subject because the tape deck ran down.
Oh, it happens.
Yeah, it does.
Usually at the worst time.
But you got Bob Hope to retake the whole thing?
Yeah, he was great. Somebody tipped me off that he was staying at the Mayo Hotel downtown Tulsa, and I called him from the lobby and woke him up, and he said, call back in 30 minutes, and then I woke him up 30 minutes later, and finally, after about three times, he said, you're not going to give up, are you? And invited me up, and he was alone. I think he was staying overnight en route to some kind of a gig he had somewhere in Stillwater or someplace. Anyway, I set up this Wolinczak and recorder and did about a 15-minute interview with him and tested it to play it back, and nothing. Mm-hmm. It just didn't record. And he was exceptionally nice. He said, don't worry about it. Let's just do it over again. And we did it over again. And he was very, very nice to me. And I found that interviewing a lot of celebrities the bigger they are, the nicer they are. It's the ones that aren't quite, you know, there that mm-hmm. turn out to be not so nice.
And Alice Cooper, a guy yeah. you interviewed several times. You don't seem like a rock dog there, Mike.
Well, I'm not exactly, but I liked Alice Cooper.
With or without his makeup?
Yes, he was without his makeup. He got off the airplane and said, "What do you do around here? Watch the grass grow at the Boulder Park." And he invited me into his private airplane. In the rear, he had nothing but centerfolds of Playboy and Penthouse and those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
Very funny guy.
Yeah, I've talked to him a couple of times. He's very interesting and knows exactly what his shtick is. Now, I'm also looking at a photograph here, and it demonstrates really what a true gentleman you are, Mike Miller, because you're standing just inches away from Jane Mansfield's chest. And while she's maintaining eye contact with the camera, you are trying to maintain eye contact with her. And her very large breasts are pumped up, pressed out, poked up into your microphone. And you don't appear to be gazing at them.
No, that took a lot of practice. actually, she kind of pushed me away, but she didn't use her hands. So.
Come on. Now, as long as we're getting a little racy here, what was the editorial decision to save toward the very end of the book the fact that at local TV stations, the film camera operators would moonlight as porn filmmakers? Because after all, they didn't have to send the film to Kodak for processing and risk having it confiscated. So first of all, tell us about that as an aspect of local TV. And then you almost got caught up in a scandal about this.
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened is that back in those days, before videotape, you had to process film. So it was sort of a challenge to photographers, people who worked in TV newsrooms. You had a processor there, and if you had a girl willing to go along with it, you could film whatever you liked and then process it yourself at 3 a.m. when no one was around. And that was done at several TV stations I worked for.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of them, the last time we did this, we had been doing a story on the police commissioner. In fact, we got him indicted. And the cops weren't real happy with me, who'd done the story. And one day, I get a call from the police chief's secretary. She said, the chief would like for you to come over and have a little chat. So I went over there, and he closed the door, and he said, "Mike, do you know anything about a stag film?" And I almost had a heart attack right there. He said, "We don't really care anything." There were two girls in this film, and he said, "We don't really care, or I don't care about your porn film that you guys shot. But we wanted to know, there was a double murder of two lesbians, and we wondered if these girls were the same ones that were in your film." And mm-hmm. I assured him that it was not the case.
Uh-huh. Now, were you the executive producer, or were you talent?
I think... Isn't there an amendment you can take, the Fifth Amendment?
You don't work for Solyndra or General Motors. I'm
no.
sorry. You're going to have to answer.
I may not ever work again.
Now, Mike, you also talk about beer in the newsroom, about 2 and 3 martini lunches, particularly in Washington when you were working at WTTG with Connie Chung and Maury Povich. And you stopped drinking about 20 years ago, and in the book you describe a lot of your not really binges, but that you were a pretty regular and steady drinker. There was a lot of stress, particularly when you were working for politicians and elected officials. And booze really did fuel the local and network news business for many years. Isn't that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. you know, in those days, it was really before Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and a lot of people drank. I mean, people drank during the day a lot more than they do today. Today, it's frowned upon. But back in those days, gosh, people would just drive around with an open beer just to get from one quick trip, 7-Eleven, or quick trip to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And, we drank on duty. We'd have a couple at lunch. And then on weekends when the bosses weren't around, you usually put a quart of beer in the desk in a paper bag. And then if somebody walked in, you'd close the drawer.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody really paid much attention to it because it was so common. I wasn't the only one. I drank way too much. Everybody was drinking way too much in those days, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
I drank wine on the radio in morning drive with all kinds of people. And, it was kind of bad boy stuff that was encouraged by management.
Yeah, I think I started in my first radio job. We used to carry the St. Louis Cardinal games, doubleheaders. I worked weekends a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And like a Sunday, there was nobody out there. I mean, I'd put maybe a 12-pack in the air conditioner behind me, which kept it ice cold.
Uh-huh.
And, about the third or fourth inning in the second game, Harry Carey and I were having a contest who was slurring their words, more.
Holy
Take
cow.
Me out to the bathroom. Yeah. I have really got to pee.
That's right. And I'd get bold enough to where I'd let Gary Chu and some of the other guys I worked with who might be listening know what I was doing. I'd give a station idea and pop the can at the same time.
Oh, man, that's funny.
Now, Mike, you worked as a radio news reporter, as a TV news reporter, then you became a TV news director, and then you kind of bounced back and forth. You were news director at a couple of stations, and then you went to Washington, where you worked as a reporter. And at a certain point, you kind of ran out of gas in television, and you shifted into politics. And you worked for Congressman Ed Bethune, who you got elected from the Little Rock area. And despite your great communication skills, I've never heard of the guy before I read your book. Did he have a claim to fame? Was there a moment where Ed Bethune really distinguished himself?
Well, I guess just getting elected in that highly Democratic district distinguished himself. That's the old Wilbur Mills seat.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first Republican elected in that district in 104 years.
Well, the Wilbur Mills effect is still alive and well. You can just ask Stephen Twitter, what's the guy's name, who just got bounced out in New York City, and a Republican won that seat.
Oh, that's right.
Wiener, I'm sorry, it's not Stephen. Wiener is the guy's name.
Right, and Wiener was his problem.
No, Twitter was his problem. He mistweeted. And his communications team was unable to call that back or issue a correction, you know?
Yeah, well, politics, I've been in radio and TV news for like 18, 20 years. And as you mentioned, you're hired and fired much like a football coach or a baseball manager.
Mm-hmm.
They can't fire the team if the ratings aren't what they want. And so they fired the news director or somebody else, the anchorman or whatever. So I thought I'd get into something a little bit more stable, like politics. And
I thought you were actually trying to find a way to make money that was more loathsome than working in television news.
No, I don't know that there's anything more loathsome.
Now, Mike, you worked for Chick Hecht, a senator from Nevada who was quite a gaffe machine, and you spent a lot of time kind of susplaining what he actually meant to say.
He did. He had a problem with gaffes. There are a few running for president that have the same problem, but I remember, Nevada was the site of the nuclear waste dump. They were going to put all the waste of the country.
Mm-hmm.
This was going on long time, and this was back in the 80s. And he was interviewed on a local TV station about it and made the comment referring to the waste dump as the nuclear suppository. And we didn't. I was in the control room.
And then
and
you were supposed to pull it out, huh?
Yeah. Well, he was live.
I forgot that one.
I didn't catch it until they played it back for us. And then, God, everybody started quoting it, and it was embarrassing. But, you know, what Senator Heck said, I said, I need you to explain this a little bit, can you? And he said, well, I'm probably the only politician who's put this issue in its proper context.
And did he say, Heck, no?
Yeah, something like that. He was an incredibly good senator. Anyone walking into his office was to be ushered, into his outer office, was to be ushered into his inner office, no matter who he was talking to, who he was meeting with. And he would take them on a tour of his office and, you know, show them around. He decorated the office like a museum of Nevada's history. And I've just never met a guy who cared that much about his constituents.
Mm-hmm. Now, the real kingmaker in Nevada was Paul Laxalt, who
right.
was very tight with Reagan, had been governor there. And I'm going to disclose something here that will shock my listeners, but I was actually not the talent, but the engineer who produced the audio tracks for all the radio and TV commercials that Paul Laxalt used when he ran for the U.S. Senate. And it was purely accidental. I had a little recording studio in Silicon Valley, and we were doing work for the Las Vegas Visitors and Convention Bureau, whatever that's called.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy named Sig Rogich was the ad agency owner who had that business, and he basically just leaned on us to do the Laxalt thing, and I had to hold my nose the whole way through. And I just rationalized it, saying, well, I'm not from Nevada. Caveat emptor. But talk about your connections with Laxalt, because you also worked as a consultant from the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, and you were parachuted in to various campaigns, usually ones that were in trouble. But in your work for Chick Hecht, you basically had to operate under the very pervasive shadow of Paul Laxalt.
No question about it. Paul Laxalt was a giant in Nevada, and he was supposedly one of Reagan's closest friends, certainly in the Senate, probably his closest friend in the Senate. And Chick was the president pro tem of the state Senate when Laxalt was governor. They became pretty good friends. And after Chick was elected, of course, Laxalt, he looked up to Laxalt, and, you know, he wouldn't do anything without Laxalt's approval. In fact,
well, but he was a shrimp. He looked up to virtually everybody.
Yeah, he was.
You disclosed that.
He was a member of the Senate. And Laxalt, though, as you probably know if you listen to him, was a masterful speaker.
Oh, yeah.
The guy just had a way. He ran for president once, mm-hmm. but got nowhere. I remember right after Chick was elected, Laxalt wanted to hire Chick's new press secretary, communications director, even though I'd been offered the job. But by that time, Chick and I had formed a bond and really worked well together. And he actually told Laxalt that he was very happy with me. Laxalt checked me out and gave his approval. But I remember at a cocktail party or something, right after the swearing-in ceremonies, Laxalt took me off in the corner and he said, we're going to put out a press release. Whenever we do put out a press release, it'll be a joint release with the two Republican senators, Chick and Laxalt, and Barbara Mikhanovich, Republican House member. the only problem with that, and we did that, but the only problem was there were four members of the delegation, and there was a Democrat named Harry Reid who was left out in the cold.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Harry appreciated that too much of press releases joint from the delegation, and he wasn't mentioned.
But on a personal level, you seem to have a high regard for Harry Reid, and he seems to have been remarkably generous to you despite the partisan differences.
Yes, he was. You know, when Chick ran for re-election and was defeated by Richard Bryan, the incumbent governor, who was very popular. And so, of course, I was out of work looking for a job, and Harry offered set me up with some interviews with some of the hotels in Las Vegas and was very instrumental in trying to help me, which I really appreciated because he didn't really have to.
Now, Mike, the one thing that I found missing from your book was any real detailed references to the ratings games and to what you did during sweeps weeks as a news director to try to jack up your ratings. So tell us a little bit about when you're a news director in Tulsa and later in Little Rock. And by the way, there you came into fairly regular contact with a guy named Bill Clinton. But what did you do? And what kind of budgets were you given to advertise the sleazy stories that you used to try to hype the ratings during the sweeps periods?
Well, maybe the reason I left it out is because we really didn't do any of it.
Oh, yeah?
We didn't do anything different during the rating sweeps. Occasionally, we might run a series that we had been working on and a five-part series on something or another, but those were rare instances. Most of the promotion was done not by the news department, but by the promotion department, and we just let them alone. They had their own little deal, and they were off in another world, and mm-hmm. sometimes we'd see stuff on the air promoting us, and sometimes we didn't.
Yeah, interesting.
It really didn't come into play that much. It seems like the ratings for local news were not so much determined by the newscasts themselves, but by the lead-ins. And if you had a good lead-in, you usually had a pretty good rating.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was often out of your control because the network generally controlled the lead-in to both your local and your 10 or 11 p.m. newscast.
Absolutely. And not only lead-in, to lead-out. You know, if you were there before, in those days, the Tonight Show had a big rating. And, if you were on right before the Tonight Show, your 10 o'clock news was usually number one without you doing anything about it.
We're talking with Mike Miller. His new book is How High Can a Guy Stoop? And before we turn to Gary Chu here, Mike, tell people how they can buy a copy of your book.
Well, it's available on Amazon.com, and there's several websites. Jerry Pippen has a website. He's got an internet radio station.
Mm-hmm.
Liberal talk show host.
Yeah. I've heard of those. They're rare, but
yeah. But you know, you've got your audience, and there's another website. If anybody's interested in Tulsa television, it's called Tulsa TV Memories, and they've got a link that I think they make it a little extra money if mm-hmm. somebody buys through their website.
Well, let's do that, because Gary Chu is a supporter of Tulsa TV Memories, too, and I've been to that website many times. Gary, join the conversation now, and first of all, take us back to when you and Mike Miller first met and worked together in Tulsa.
I think it was at KTUL AM Radio, and Mike did a late night shift, and then I think you went more into news after that, didn't you, Mike?
After the station was sold that I really went in full time news.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working my way through TU, University of Tulsa, and mm-hmm. working nights, so I had the night shift, and it was tough.
That was exactly what I had come to Tulsa and was doing a late evening DJ show, and then carrying a heavy load during the day at school. I think that's how we became good friends, and we had a lot of, common things going on in our lives, and we're only about 6 months apart in age. So it was a definite resonance going on between the two of us.
Mm-hmm. And so then, Gary, when did you break into television? Because Mike mentions you in the book as doing TV weather forecasts.
Well, I was working at the then evolved station of KTUL, which was then it had become KELI, Kelly, they called it. And I got a call from Mike one day, and he said, one of the weather guys here at KOTV is leaving, and why don't you come down and audition for it? And I'd never been on TV before, you know, obviously, and I, you know, I, it kind of scared me. And so I did, and I got the job. And so and to return the favor, I introduced Mike to his wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we just celebrated our 50th anniversary last month.
Holy cow. Wow, that's amazing.
My best to Mary Beth, by the way.
Yeah, you bet.
And how did you know Mary Beth, Gary?
Well, that was interesting. I was dating a girl in Tulsa, and I had forgotten. I have even forgotten her name to this day. I remember what she looked like in my mind.
That doesn't help us. We're on radio, dude.
You remember her profile.
Yeah, actually, it was her profile I was thinking about. Anyway, she said, I have a girlfriend of mine is coming up to Tulsa to spend the weekend with me. She's from Fort Smith. And she said, maybe you could fix her up or when we can go out on a double date. And I immediately thought of Mike Miller. You know what I mean? Same age, same thing, handsome guy, you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And they sort of hit it off for at least 50 years so far.
And was that five moves back and forth from either Tulsa or Little Rock to Washington?
How many moves?
I'm guessing five from the book.
Yeah, probably. I went to Dallas, was worked in there at one point.
Right.
When I was in D.C., working with Connie Chung and Bob Schieffer and some people who were just really starting out their TV careers, after a couple of years, I got a call from the guy who, Bob Gregory, who hired, I guess, Gary and me both at KTUL. He was at KTUL TV, and he said, how would you like to be news director at Channel 8? So I got to come back as news director, which is, I guess, something I'd always, in the back of my mind, wanted to do. But, you know, you work and you, as we've said, the ratings may not be what, or you have a clash, a personality clash with somebody, and so that was...
Mike, could I interrupt you and ask you a question? Who was the guy who called you? Because that's not ringing a bell in my head. The guy who called you, how would you like to be the news director of Channel 8?
Bob Gregory.
Oh, I thought you said somebody other than Bob Gregory.
No.
All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was Bob Gregory, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You could never mistake someone else for...
No,
Bob Gregory, because
no.
He had a voice.
He's got a voice that's deeper, slightly deeper than Peter B's, which is saying quite
a bit. Oh, my God.
Yeah. He used to read the news on CBS, news, the network.
I've never heard a voice so low in my life.
Ken Nordine, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Actually, anyway, I ended up going to Dallas and then coming back to Channel 8 and then going to Little Rock and... You have to move around if you want to get a raise, if you want to increase your... In those days, there were no unions, no way of increasing your pay, and you could threaten to leave, and they'd say bye. And, you know, if somebody else offered you a better job, more money, you'd jumped at it.
Now, Mike,
you change jobs.
Do you have an AFTRA pension? Because you worked at AFTRA shops for a while, right?
Yeah, after you're gone. I was only in Washington for a couple of years, and my AFTRA pension, I think, is $95 a month.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
Do you
spend all of that in one place, Mike, every month?
It's kind of embarrassing. In a way, I'm kind of sorry I didn't just stay there, and because AFTRA has terrific benefits if you want, you know, get their health and dental and...
Well, I spent 11 years on the National Board of AFTRA, and my primary goal was to preserve the pension funds. And I hope there's something left when I get there.
Yeah, I think it's being well preserved.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I want to ask you next about behind-the-scenes stuff at local television stations. And I want to share a story with you that I've never found a proper context for. My dad was a small business operator in Cincinnati. And we had a local television station there that was owned by Scripps Howard, WCPO. And it featured a very popular morning kids show hosted by Uncle Al. And so the sales department of the TV station approached my father and asked him if he wanted to advertise on Channel 9. And he expressed some interest. He had a product that would fit on this this kids show. And so they said, well, would you like to go to lunch with Uncle Al? And he said, okay. And so he did, and that morning he told his kids, I'm going to lunch with Uncle Al. And we were so impressed. So I learned later, he didn't tell this to me at the time because I was too young, but when I was older, he related the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey might say. He went to lunch with the host of the kids show, Uncle Al, and after lunch, Al took him to the penthouse suite of the hotel where the radio arm of this conglomerate had its antenna farm. And he went into the suite, and there were three girls there. And Al said, well, I got to get back to the station. You can stay as long as you like. And according to my dad, he bolted. He left with Uncle Al. But he said it was a very clear trap where he wasn't sure if there were hidden cameras or exactly what. But he thought that this wholesome, you know, Wonder Bread TV host was going to lead him into a blackmail scheme.
Gee whiz.
And I just wanted to ask if you guys ever saw those kinds of tactics used in order to get business on the books at TV or radio stations where you worked. Mike, you first.
Not really. I've heard of stories like that, but I've never witnessed any.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Gary has.
I have not. I worked for a Christian station once. Yeah, there are other forms of dishonesty I have witnessed, but not something like that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, what kind of shenanigans did you experience in local radio or TV? Because I'll give you one more. My first job was at a Christian radio station because I wanted to get something on the back of my FCC license so I could get a real job sometime. And I don't know if this was some kind of a test of my honesty or what, but, you know, we were playing these reel-to-reel tapes of different religious broadcasters, and the first thing I noticed was that they'd say this is the hour of something or other, hour of redemption or the Bible hour, and none of the shows were actually an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day I opened up the tape from Reverend, his name was Naramore. He was from Orange County, California. And he had a show where he basically talked about all these pamphlets that he wrote, and he would create a problem, and you would write in to get his pamphlet to know the solution. So I open up the tape box, and a $50 bill dropped out.
Mm.
So I immediately went to the station manager, Reverend Crouch, and I said, hey, I opened up this box, and $50 fell out. And he said, I'll take that. He said, that's their offering. I said, offering? He said, yeah, everybody makes an offering to get their shows on this station.
Mm.
And I said, oh, well, do you have a rate card? And in fact, he did. He pulled it out of his drawer and he said, yeah, sure, you know, a 5-minute show is $50.
Mm-hmm.
And I was appalled because I thought that religious stations were non-commercial and that they weren't accepting money. In any form.
You were naive, Peter B.
I was.
Well, it would have been me. I'd have told the station manager, a dollar bill fell out. Here it is.
You were a very honest young announcer, Peter B.
Well, it was like my second day on the job, and like I said, I thought it was actually a test.
Oh yeah, right.
To see
could
if...
Could have been, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're that smart.
Uh-huh.
Well, my story about working early on in radio, my very first radio job was in my small hometown before I ever moved to Tulsa. It was in northern Oklahoma. I won't give the exact locations for all of it because, it's sort of a pejorative story, but the guy who bought the station out from under the other guy that I was working for came in, and he was a radio preacher, like the ones you've been describing, and he would he had a whole series of preacher sermons going through the day, and I always felt it was kind of I didn't think it was quite right, and I wasn't quite sure why, because I was only about 18 years old. And then I found out that and I need to put a clause in here to continue the story. I have no problems with people being homosexuals. It's their business. However, mm-hmm. this guy was a homosexual, but he was a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of like an Idaho senator, mm-hmm. some of the others. And then his general manager also was gay, and the gay guy hit on me one time, and I said, please, no, thank you. And I thought, well, these guys, then my little 18-year-old brain said, well, these guys are really kind of dishonest because they're talking about Jesus and being not committing sin or doing things that are naughty and other things, you know, on the radio all the time, and they're making money off of this. And that was my first introduction to broadcast, and I was 18, like I say, in a small town in northern Oklahoma, and I realized that, well, there must be some other kinds of businesses going on in broadcast that maybe aren't above board. You know, this was 1955 or something like that, or 54. I can't remember exactly.
Well, that's before the game show scandals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you didn't mention Larry Craig, but you still inspired me to drop this in here, Gary. Yeah.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.
Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.
Most people go to the airport bathroom to relieve themselves before their next flight. But not you. No. You're looking to become a member of the Ground Level Club.
Not what they mean by a layover.
You, Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman, voted against gay marriage. That's because you want to have as many partners as you can, in as many cans as you can.
A romantic toilet rendezvous.
Come on, sir. You are gay, aren't you?
That's not what I said on C-SPAN.
So the next time you're in the airport lavatory stall and see a polished wingtip tap, tap, tapping to make your acquaintance, run away, or you might be the belle of the bathroom ball with Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman, a real American hero.
Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.
Sorry, guys, I couldn't resist.
Oh, dear me.
He had a wide stance on the issues.
Oh, he certainly did. Now, Mike, you talk about some of the parties that were conducted in Capitol office buildings, congressional office buildings, with a lot of booze, and you said that marijuana smoke was wafting up the stairwells at times.
Oh, it was very prevalent in those days. You know, you could walk by certain offices or stairwells and get a big whiff of it. And I've been told that there was a committee, or it was the post office. They had their own post office in the...
Sure, that's where I used to bounce checks.
Yeah, exact same place. Well, that was a good place to buy marijuana. You could buy whatever you wanted in there, but marijuana mostly. And it was known as the Joint Committee. Oh boy! Hey, let me
go ahead, Gary.
Give me a little distraction here. I went since you're tying in my review of the new Clooney film. When I went to see it the other night, I saw it very late Thursday night before it opened the next day, and somebody, one of my friends here in town, who is also a former Capitol reporter for public radio here in Sacramento, said they probably held it late because it was Sacramento, such a political town. But anyway, I had to hurry and see the film on Thursday evening, last Thursday. And then the friend and I who went to the movie went by Cesar Chavez Park, right mm-hmm. down in the very heart of Sacramento, to the latest Wall Street thing that's going on around everywhere.
Occupy, yeah.
Yeah, and we walked by this tent where they had a few computers and stuff, and they were marching and doing all this, and I could smell dope. I mean, I could smell marijuana wafting through the air. You know, when Mike said that about how it was back in those days, it reminded me that, well, maybe things haven't changed so much after all these days.
Well, I think it's been fueling a lot of activism over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, gentlemen, before we wrap up, I wanted to get your thoughts on the state of television news today. And let's start with the local news, because, Mike, that was your primary focus, and we'll talk about the network level in a second.
Okay.
But, Mike, what is your sense? It's not as if any of us, I think, fantasize that there was a golden era of television news when it was all, you know, pure journalism and just the finest reporting ever. But there were a lot of great people who worked at local television stations in individual markets who really defined the culture of those communities. We recently lost Bob McKenzie and Roland Post, two people who worked for more than 30 years each on television news here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And each of them had a very clear persona and personality and a kind of depth of knowledge that we all could connect with. And their credibility was enhanced because of their collective knowledge and the history that they imparted to us on a regular basis. And most of those types of people have been laid off in the budget cuts that have been prevalent in the last 10 years as the corporate owners of television stations scramble to try to maintain the 40% operating margins that they enjoyed for really three decades straight.
It's terrible. Most newsrooms are just looking for ways to cut costs. Or a lot of them, too, are lazy. And I think it's a combination. The old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. That's pretty much, you know, the goal of every newscast, it seems. The overnight shootings are usually now shot by a stringer or a freelance photographer. When I worked at Channel 9 in Washington, I used to ask the producer, why do we report all these shootings every night? I thought the definition of news was that it was something unusual or different.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got a clear response. And, you know, there's very little investigative reporting or enterprise reporting. A station just relies on the wire services or what's in the newspaper to find out what's happening. And when I was a news director, I established a beat system where my reporters were more or less forced to develop sources, and they would check with them on a daily basis, and we would get our stories straight from the horse's mouth. I don't see any of that anymore. There may be a modified beat system where you may have a reporter who specializes in medical news or consumer affairs.
Right, yeah.
But those aren't really news. I mean, those are more features and almost bordering on entertainment.
Yeah.
And it's changed, I think. A lot of the people who were in local news have graduated to network news.
Mm-hmm.
A couple that Gary and I worked with.
Gary, your comments?
Mike, talking there made me think of just watching the new Brian Williams NBC Evening News promo that's online in the last day or so. I don't know if either of you have seen it yet. I sent it out by email to some people.
I haven't looked at it yet.
Okay, anyway, let me tell you quickly what it is. Brian Williams is doing a low-key Jon Stewart, basically, because at the end of the promo, he says, right over here, we're putting in a pasta bar. But he's doing it like Brian Williams would do it, not Jon Stewart. That's what's going on, and it's very subtly happening, and it obviously Colbert and Stewart had great influence on television news in general in terms of its tone, and NBC is going for it, and it's not bad or unprofessional looking in terms of how it looks on the air. It's just that here's Brian Williams talking about a pasta bar on a news promo, and my contention is, and my position is that what bothers me about that it all began with the right-wing talk radio shows becoming so popular so many years ago, and it's become a ping-pong match back and forth between that beginning and now what we have in the strictest form, I suppose, would be Keith Olbermann, you know, who's been so, to some people, outrageous. He has gone to a television cable a distribution thing that I can't even get where I live because there's a tree in the way.
Well, I do get it, and I think Keith is continuing to do almost as good a job as he did at MSNBC. He simply lacks some of the resources. He can't always flip to a correspondent or to even a guest on a remote, and so there are some limits on what he does. But I do understand your point, Gary, and the impact of Jon Stewart is something we can't underestimate. And he frequently shames the corporate network and local media in this country by exposing either hypocrisy or a failure to explore some of the most obvious questions. And when Stewart does it, it sometimes actually produces a reaction from news people where they then are shamed or somehow embarrassed into pursuing a story that they should have been on top of to begin with.
Well, I think Jon Stewart, in a way, is sort of a new age Will Rogers. I don't know. You guys kicked that around in your head for a while. What do you think? I mean, didn't Rogers kind of rattle the cage of politicians back in the day in Oklahoma?
Yeah, I'm not quite that old. But,
well, me either, Mike.
I understand that's true. I agree with Gary that I think that most people today don't really care about current events or politics, but they get what news they do get from Jon Stewart and similar type shows. And as a result, the network news is their dwindling. And it is developed into a mishmash of spot news, disasters, politics, war coverage with features worked in on consumers, financial, health related tips.
Well, and I don't want to get ageist here, but when you watch the half-hour nightly network newscasts on the old Big Three, look at the commercials. They're they're for adult diapers. They're for Viagra.
You know, I have an idea, Peter B., for a bit you could put on your show, or maybe Mike and I could even do it together some way. We could do a report every once in a while called Now, Stay Tuned for What You Want to Hear News. You know, because I think there's a lot of that. Because, you know, I feel myself wanting to be entertained slightly by hearing somebody say, report that news that I like to hear. And I don't want to hear, say, somebody over on Fox News telling me something because I know they're going to cover that story and they're always going to give it another twist. So you get people, so that divides us even more as a communications country in terms of taking in stuff from the media.
Yeah. Now, you went ahead and dropped the F-bomb there, so let's pursue it a little bit. Mike, what do you take away from Fox News? You referenced that you met Roger Ailes when you were working for the Republican Senate Campaign Committee. He certainly has reshaped the news landscape, and in my opinion, we're all much worse off for it.
I don't know. It's very popular. Look at their ratings. They've got about three times the viewership of MSNBC and CNN. I don't agree with Gary that everything is slanted to the right. I think there are a couple of shows that are certainly conservative.
Well, let me offer you one example, okay?
Right.
Because I do watch Fox for an hour or two a week, just because I think it's my job, my duty. And they don't offer, for example, a full range of views, even though they say they're fair and balanced. So in all of the discussion about the debt and the Republican bender now to cut the national debt and reduce the deficit, the operating deficit, they never reference the facts that the deficit went up at the highest levels under Reagan, second highest under George W. Bush, third under Clinton before, that was really in his first 4 years, and Obama has increased the national debt less than any president who is still alive today. Yet the impression you get from Fox is that the deficit skyrocketed the moment Barack Obama lifted his hand from the Bible in January of 2009. And they never referenced the possibility of raising taxes as a way of dealing with the debt and the deficit.
Well, I don't know. You know, those are opinion shows, and I don't agree with a lot of them. I don't watch Fox News that much. I probably watch MSNBC more because I want to see how bizarre they can get, and they do get pretty bizarre. I mean, to me, they're farther to the left than Fox is to the right.
Hmm. Well, I don't quite share that, but that just defines some of our worldviews.
Fox News doesn't start and end each program with an attack on the Democratic Party.
Well, I will say this, that currently, and I watch Rachel Maddow's show most frequently of those on MSNBC, she barely mentions anything about the Democrats or Obama. Her show is all opposition research on the Republican candidates for president
right now. That's all they talk about.
Mm-hmm. And,
she's not the only one. Almost every show on there, they'll start off with an attack on Kane or Perry or whoever the flavor of the day is. But, you know, Fox doesn't start off every newscast with an attack on Obama or the Democratic Party. They don't say that
it's the second story.
Their rhetoric isn't nearly as strong or vitriolic. But I usually watch CNN because I think they probably come closest to being balanced.
I agree.
And here's one of my problems is that CNN is, in my view, so busy chasing Fox News that they are abandoning any sense of centrism or balance. And let me give you this example. They co-sponsored a recent GOP presidential debate forum with the Tea Party Express, which is a freestanding political operation. And, Mike, you understand how these things work. Sal Russo is a political consultant from Sacramento. He bought a bus and called it the Tea Party Express. He has raised millions of dollars and paid himself and his wife very large sums of money as consultants. And they were given standing by CNN as if they were the League of Women Voters. And they co-produced this debate. They selected the individual citizens from Cincinnati and other remote locations who were allowed to ask questions. And the whole thing was framed around the alleged precepts of the alleged Tea Party. And I found it deeply offensive and heavily skewed. And it wasn't really about serving the American people. It was about trying to jack up the ratings at CNN and persuade some Fox News viewers that, hey, we cover the Tea Party, too. We like the Tea Party over here, too. Don't just look at Fox. And I find that very troubling.
You may be right. I didn't draw that conclusion. I mean, I see so much of CNN that is where they have one, a liberal and a conservative on. I'm talking more about their... I usually watch Wolf Blitzer, and I think he's pretty straight and narrow. But, you know, they used to have Glenn Beck on, but they got rid of him.
Silence.
Yeah, I can't say much about their decision to drop him because...
my point is, if they were really going after Fox viewers, why didn't they keep him?
Oh, you mean CNN?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he's so bizarre that I find it hard to understand.
Bizarre for Fox.
Yeah, yeah. Well, gentlemen, Gary, you want to add a comment there, and then we'll wrap
Not
up.
Not really.
Here?
I think we've covered it rather well, better than what I thought we might.
All right.
Truth.
Well, Gary Chu and Mike Miller, thank you for joining me and sharing your memories from your careers. And again, I want to recommend the book, How High Can a Guy Stoop?, a recently published memoir from Mike Miller. Find it at Amazon.com or help out TulsaTVMemories.com and go buy it there. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Gary, thank you.
Thank you to both of you.
Enjoyed it.
Now, as promised, here's the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, Gary Chu, taking a look at George Clooney's new political drama called The Ides of March. Take it away, Gary.
A far better writer than I has already spread the news, or in this case, the message one takes away from George Clooney's new film, The Ides of March. The line would be, all the world's a stage. I would add only that if you subscribe to Mr. Clooney's messaging, those wielding or seeking power, especially elective office, trod those boards more than all other mortals combined. No, not any kind of revelation. and not much different from what Robert Redford said in The Candidate or Gore Vidal in his play and the subsequent film The Best Man. Since The Ides of March presents a fictional account of an Ohio presidential primary scheduled for a calendar date that proved to be in ancient Rome a bad hair day for Julius Caesar, Republicans will be happy to know that The Ides of March is just about Democrats. The screenwriters Clooney and Grant Heslov and the originating playwright Bo Willimon perceive the party of the people as being quite adroit at betrayal. But a quick cautionary note for conservative politicians and those who vote for them. The values homily sprinkled across the arc of this excellent film, spoken through the characters Ryan Gosling and George Clooney inhabit, especially, make Democrats seem like kindergartners in misrepresentation when compared to their distinguished colleagues across the aisle. Something about the narrative in a moment after an obligatory discussion of the cast. It may be the best damn cast ever assembled in a contemporary American film. Only thing, Meryl Streep isn't in it, but there is a character in it who looks like Miss Streep, sort of, and does her brief appearance as I think Streep might have. Her name is Jennifer Ayle. She plays Cindy, the wife of the governor running for the presidency. The rest of the cast I list by actor, the character he or she does, and a thumbnail of how each role plays in the complex story. Ryan Gosling is Stephen, second banana in the Morris campaign. George Clooney, Ohio Governor Morris, a liberal Democrat. Philip Seymour Hoffman is Paul, Morris's campaign manager. Paul Giamatti is Tom, Morris's primary opponent's campaign manager. Evan Rachel Wood is Molly, daughter of the DNC chairman. Marisa Tomei is Ida, a perspicacious reporter for The Times. Jeffrey Wright, U.S. Senator Thompson from North Carolina, and Gregory Itzen is chairman of the Democratic National Committee. An asterisk should also be placed next to Itzen's name for the brief but powerfully moving speech his character gives at the two-thirds mark. There just isn't a bad actor in the bunch. Anyone who's ever seen any of these artists in their best films knows that. It's an across-the-board great delivery from all. And Ryan Gosling can be so convincing when he brings on his empty, gaunt, existential stare that focuses on nothing. Real TV newsies who show up briefly, or the sound of their voices heard at least, are Rachel Maddow, Chris Matthews, John King, and Charlie Rose. Less liberal or progressive persons attached to other media are Matt Drudge and Sean Hannity. Roll call is also mentioned. Studying the character list just given might tip you off as to how pieces shift on the chessboard while the film moves closer to the middle of March and reveals who gets the last laugh, if anyone who does such things as portrayed in the film could ever laugh again without faking it. Ryan Gosling's facial expression just mentioned sums that up. Original music for The Ides of March to these music lover ears is exquisite. Alexander Desplat wrote it and orchestrated much of it as well. The London Symphony Orchestra performs it. Then there's the male singer in a Cincinnati hotel bar who belts out way too few bars of the splendid Matt Dennis tune, Angel Eyes. As the Dennis song ends, little did I know that one of the principal characters later in The Ides of March would make me think the song's closing phrase, "Excuse me, while I disappear," should be given. But before those words can be spoken, the film fades to black. Reading a film review by the guy with his voice is casting a metaphorical vote for him. Do so online at TulsaTVMemories.com or at the big database in the sky known as the International Movie Database. That's at IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
What do you say, Trigger? Why don't we ride over toward Tulsa? Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until